You're listening to Spilling Ink.
Spilling Ink is brought to you by Book Branders, your self-publishing concierge.
There was once a time when the gods were gods without question, when men were men without example, when heroes were only the frivolous dreams of lurid mortality.
That's a great book.
Welcome, everyone, to Spilling Ink. I am the Jason Lavelle, and I'm wishing all of you a valorous evening. Welcometh to our show. I have with me this raggedy lass, Katie Salitis. Katie, how are you on this evening?
You know what? I bite my thumb at thee.
I bite my thumb at thee.
Oh, do you quarrel, sir?
I do quarrel. You filthy Dutchman's beard.
Oh, someone's been studying.
I have a whole list over here, actually. Well, welcome again to the show, everybody. Let the awesomeness begin. That's right, Anita. We are glad to have you on tonight. Okay, so before we get too crazy and Katie totally derails this conversation, as she does every week, I do want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, Book Branders. Book Branders is your self-publishing concierge. And what they do is they do all the dirty work that we don't want to do. We write the books and they can do the editing for you. They can do the formatting. They can do your website design. They can do all that crap that just slows you down and gets you out of your groove. And I know Katie's worked with them. She assures me they're great people. In fact, Katie is one of those people, aren't you?
Don't give away my secrets.
All right. We don't want to give away too many of Katie's secrets. But yeah, so check them out, bookbranders.com. Really cool people. And we have two very cool people with us here tonight, Mr. Joshua Robinson and Andy Pellic. I thought we were doing something different with your name tonight, Andy.
Yeah, the Sir Pellican, the mildly courageous. Was that okay. The name that we were going with?
Sir Pellican, the mildly courageous. but basically, tonight is Fantasy Author Fest because we have these two awesome fantasy authors. Actually, Katie's a fantasy author, so it's right. Total fantasy going on here. So how's everybody doing tonight?
Very good.
It's been an awesome Saturday.
It's been a long week and a great day of not doing any work.
Awesome. That's sweet. Josh, I have to say, you sound especially deep and sexy tonight.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Could you say something for me? Could you say something about, hey, Rebecca, this is Josh. It's really good to see you tonight.
Hey, Rebecca, this is Josh. You're a frothy, unwashed, horn beast, and it's really good to see you.
You better be watching.
You're welcome, Rebecca. Hopefully you are watching, and you're not just being a crusty batch of nature somewhere.
Did you guys ever watch that old British comedy on, like, PBS called Are You Being Served?
I have not.
There was a guy who had a very high-pitched voice, and he worked in the clothing department. And anytime the phone rang, he would answer it, and he'd go, menswear, and like just as low and deep as he possibly could, like hide his feminine voice. Is hilarious.
<That's awesome. laughs> All right, so most everybody who watches this show knows who you two are, but I'm going to have you guys do the introduction anyway. So Josh, tell us a little bit about you.
Absolutely. My name is Joshua Robertson. I'm an author of grimdark or dark fantasy novellas and novels, most known for the Thrice Nine Legends saga. I live in North Carolina with my very talented wife and horde of goblins. I also run the Writer Imperfect podcast over on Twitch and iTunes, and I've written a few books. I enjoy them. If you guys can check them out, it's a little bit about me. I have a degree in social work with minors in psychology and sociology, and been writing full-time now for a couple of years.
Awesome. Andy, what about you, sir?
Well, I am Andy Pellicwin, author of slightly less grim and dark fantasy than what Joshua writes. I don't have a super cool name for all of my stories, so I've just got series named The Hero of Darkness, Queen of Thieves, and now the new Heirs of Destiny series. I am the intelligent, slightly less handsome half of the Fantasy Fiends podcast, where we delve into all awesome things related to fantasy and basically have an hour of fun every week dealing in fantasy fiction.
That's awesome. I could get down with that. That's good. And then we have She Who Must Not Be Named up there, which I'm totally jealous of your name. I wish I could go in and change mine now. Not cool.
Well, you are the Jason Lavelle.
That's right. And, you know, I actually changed the intro to the new podcast to reflect that because I figure, well, I have to keep this going now since clearly it's caught on throughout the world. Oh, so and Joshua, excuse me, he calls BS on that? What part of that are you calling BS on, Joe?
Yeah, I was really worried about what part of my statement was
called. The dark fantasy novels or the good looking one?
You are a very nice looking man, Andy. I'll give you that.
And the thing is, so in order to make peace, you know, to keep the peace with Stevie Collier, my co-host, I can say with very clearly that I am the more intelligent half, but I kind of have to give him the handsome, or else, you know.
Oh, you're on with Steve Collier?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, dude. Yeah, he's that is a nice looking human being right there.
That's Jason's secret man crush.
Don't tell him that.
Oh yeah, well yeah, you know, I think you may have called that correctly then. Yeah. Now that I know all the now Joe says both. Joe, you're so sweet, Joe. What a nice guy. So Joshua, I actually started reading, is it Annerfell? Is that how we pronounce it?
It is. It's Annerfell.
Yes. Yes. I just started reading that the other night because I've been so swamped with submissions for the new show that I just haven't had time for anything else, but I'm already loving it.
Oh, well, thank you.
These guys are brutal though, man. Freaking Drast is just a nut. I mean, it's like page three and he's already whacking somebody he's not supposed to be killing. Oh yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. That novel actually was an idea that my brother and I, JC Boyd, had back in 2002, 2004, somewhere in there. And we sat down one day, decided we were going to write a book together. We spent 7 hours or so working on the book, just back and forth, trying to put words to paper. And after 7 hours, we wrote about 3 pages. We were ready to kill each other. about done with the entire process. And then it essentially sat on the back burner and was a topic of conversation for almost a decade before we finally found a way to maybe we matured enough, but finally to sit down and finish the novel and then continue writing other books together. But yeah, it was a concept we had way back in the day. It was writing that story from two evil POVs and essentially keeping it all in their framework and watching their epic quest. And essentially the sense, well, I don't want to give away the ending, but it's dark fantasy. So,
well,
they kill people.
Yeah, they're going to kill
people. Well, and Rebecca says she has a new ringtone now. So I'm very happy that was good for her. But so is this, what kind of fantasy is this? What do you call this?
Well, I usually identify it as dark fantasy or grimdark. Okay. But I've had readers, mark it as being high fantasy as well. So I think it really depends on your palette and what you think is being too dark necessarily. I think that's pretty dark. I think Andy's told me that it's pretty dark. He says it's darker than his at least. But it does have all the things that high fantasy has. You have a whole different magic system and races and an epic expanding world and the history and a whole god system and all these things that fall into it that really make it feel very full and of life and those types of things that people are looking for in high fantasy. And it's all everything in Thrice Nine Legends is based on Slavic mythology. So Russian, Romanian, Czechoslovakian, which is why some of the language and words and stuff are weird for new readers. But yeah, that's where I put it. I usually say dark fantasy, but readers will tell me it's high fantasy too.
Yeah. So I think high fantasy is like the umbrella category, like epic. Epic and high are usually used interchangeably. High and low are usually used for magic and no magic, but Joshua, yours is squarely in the realm of dark fantasy. It doesn't quite go into grimdark as far as grimdark has been defined, but it's classic because it's based on, like you said, mythology, but the horror elements of the mythology. So it's like all of your favorite horror tales from Slavic mythology put into this fantasy world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, cool. Last week we had Robert Cano on talking about his grimdark stories. and he gave us his definition of grimdark. So what do you guys say makes a story go from dark fantasy to grimdark?
Well, I will field that one. We actually had one guy on our podcast who was doing, I think it's a master's degree in Master of Fine Arts, and his thesis was on grimdark, and he basically codified grimdark, broke it down into seven aspects based on, of course, the literature, the fiction that is classified as grimdark, like Joe Abercrombie's stuff. Mainly, he's sort of the king. His name is Lord Grimdark on Twitter because he's sort of the one who created the genre. But basically, it breaks down to a world at war, like not just, you know, the sort of squabbling between things, but actually like proper war. Sort of a grim ambiance. Like the whole tone of the story is much grimmer. The world is bleak and not a lot of happiness in it. Let's see. The gods are either dead or they don't exist in the world, or there's no interaction with the world. The people are pretty much self-centered assholes, which your characters definitely qualify as in this case, John. And there were three other ones that I don't remember offhand, but the thing that separates, I would say, Josh, your story as dark fantasy is the fact that it's so horror centric. All of this stuff is built around these pretty classic ancient horror myths. And grimdark isn't going to be so focused on the supernatural aspect of things to the degree that yours are. Your magic system and stuff like that. Magic is a thing, but it's not as much, not as strong a component in grimdark as it is in, say, dark fantasy.
So is grimdark then kind of a fantasy noir then kind of thing?
It's less noir and more like the dystopian, as it were, like fantasy dystopian, which doesn't really make full sense because dystopian is genre in itself, but it's sort of like the world's gone to shit in every sense of the word. And it's just a bunch of shitty people. So, you know, you've got like think of all of the bad guys in Walking Dead. That's what this world of grimdark would be populated by.
Okay. Interesting. Well, and you know, I don't write really in the fantasy genre, so a lot of this stuff is really new to me, trying to learn how people see all these different, kind of subgenres within fantasy. Katie, what would you call what you write with your Agents of Assets and your, of course, you write a couple different genres as well.
Yeah, I play around in the fantasy pool. Agents of Asset, I categorize as supernatural urban fantasy. Different than paranormal because it's less on the ghostly side, more on the fae side. So I categorize that one as supernatural urban fantasy. My werewolf series, the Little Werewolf series, that's definitely urban fantasy, YA. The one that I have a problem categorizing is the Chronicles of the Uprising series, because it's dystopian and it's also supernatural fantasy, but it's kind of like really a toe in each world.
Yeah, I don't have a good genre. I really kind of screwed myself with what I decided to write. Mine is, we say paranormal suspense, but it's really just magical realism. You know, it's all grounded in the real world, but magical or supernatural stuff happens to the characters on occasion. And really, it's been a bitch of a time trying to market it, because go ahead and tell someone, yeah, I write magical realism, and see what kind of look they give you. They're going to be like, yeah, okay. You mean horror, thriller, or fantasy? I mean, that's what I read.
Doesn't speculative fiction kind of fall into that same area as well?
Yeah.
I've heard those put up together too. Yeah, Shane Wilson writes magical realism, speculative fiction stuff too, and I think he's found that same struggle.
Yeah, and the people that like speculative fiction, I mean, will love it. They eat it up, and they're diehard fans, but they are very few and far between. It's not like fantasy fans who are like, you throw a rock down the street and you're going to hit three people who love fantasy. I mean, I know I do. I don't write fantasy, but I love to read it. So
you like throwing rocks at people? God.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, that's something we do here in America, Andy. Come on.
Well, and I know that's one thing that's been, I think I didn't expect that when I wanted to be a writer young. I used to go and pick up books, And I would just grab books and read them. And I never thought really about genre or where they fell at or even who the authors were. I just went and picked up books from the library and grabbed whatever looked interesting and brought it home and read it without ever thinking twice about it. And now as a writer, it's like people are constantly dissecting and slicing and categorizing and putting things into their own little box of this is where this belongs. And it's really complicated. I think it's complicated to market. It's complicated to find readers. I just hope we don't break it down anymore. We already have. Like, let's just keep what we have.
That's just the result of the modernization of the, you know, the reading world, and also you know, technology. Like back when we were of library going, bookstore going age, you know, there were, I'm going to say, 20,000 fantasy novels. You know, we're talking Wheel of Time, Sword of Truth, you know, Shannara, all of that. There were maybe 50 really well-known fantasy authors sort of competing for your attention. Now we're in the tens of thousands of authors, and then of course the hundreds of thousands or even millions of books. So now it's like you've got to break it down, or else it's just this massive pool of fantasy that would be no way for people to have any, you know, any way to navigate.
Well, and it's interesting too how readers have changed, I think, their way of thinking about books too. As many of you know, I went to a lot of conventions last year. My wife and I attended about 40 different conventions, and folks come up to the table and they say, what do you write? What genre is it? Where does it fall at? Who do you write like? And there's a compare and contrast to your novels to other people. And it's how they kind of get a quick idea of whether or not they're going to like it or not. So it's a whole different way of thinking about it for writers and readers alike. And you're right, Andy, it has a lot to do with this new modernization of writing and how many writers there really are.
Yeah, and also people just, you know, knowing more. People just learn more stuff because we spend all of our time, you know, scrolling through Facebook and we see articles that catch our eye or BuzzFeed lists or, you know, whatever it is. We're always taking in a lot more information that has nothing to do with our lives specifically, but it's, you know, the things that we're interested in. We've become a lot more informed and educated, maybe not useful information, but we know more. So then you figure out in a way what you like more.
We're also in the age of the digital opinion, where somebody can leave a review, a comment, an opinion at the drop of a hat on any number of social media sites. So as people do that, you see a lot more discussion happening, a lot more breakdown of what people liked versus didn't like. You get a lot of trolls in the mix too, but there's a lot more of that exchange of thoughts and opinions, whereas it used to be just small book clubs that were set apart from the social media availability. So now we're seeing that just spread out across the way.
Yeah. And I've found that the more I read like insightful reviews, not the ones like, oh, great book, shitty book, but like the ones that are actually have some value where the author, you know, kind of dissects, okay, there was this aspect of the book that I really connected with, and there was this. I find that it sort of clarifies my thoughts and feelings on the matter. So it helps me to understand what connected me to that book, which informs my decisions in the future as well.
Yeah, and then going back to the whole going to cons and conventions like that, you have that comp list in your head. So when somebody does walk up and say, what do you write? Well, it's like this and this.
Now, Andy, being the more intelligent half of your podcast, here's a big wild question for you. Who is the best currently writing fantasy author out there right now?
In my opinion, it's Brandon Sanderson.
Is who?
Brandon Sanderson.
Okay.
A lot of authors will tell you that his stories aren't, you know, there's a lot of things, sort of like Stephen King. A lot of people shoot the shit out of Stephen King's writing style. You know, he uses adverbs. He's not the best writer, but his stories are super awesome. Like, he's a storyteller, and he's found a way to make it work. Brandon Sanderson, there are a lot of authors who will pick apart various technical aspects, story structure, things like that. But when it comes down to it, I would have to say anyone who literally breaks the internet with his latest book release, he hit number one, which is something completely unheard of for fantasy in the last decade almost. I would say that he's probably the one of the top five, I would say the number one fantasy author writing today.
Okay. And he's high fantasy, right?
Yeah, he does high fantasy. He also has ventured into sci-fi, a little urban fantasy. He's got a little bit of everything.
And he's been writing for a while, but He really got his foot in the door when he took over the Wheel of Time series from Robert Jordan after he passed. At least that's my understanding of it. Like, that's what his big, that's when things really started getting busy for him, is when he took over that series and finished it up. He just skyrocketed after that.
You know, he was already.
But he was writing. Yeah.
He was sort of a name in his own right. Like, I think he had the first few Mistborn books out, maybe the first two. Mm-hmm. And but sort of the taking over of the Wheel of Time was almost like a symbolic passing of the torch, in that the Wheel of Time defined fantasy just as much as Lord of the Rings did. It's something that defines the genre. And so when it was like, all right, now Brandon Sanderson is writing the new version of the Bible, essentially, it basically was a symbolic thing that made people sit up and take notice of him, like Josh said.
Mm-hmm. He's the one who teaches as a professor at BYU, doesn't he?
Yeah.
You can go on YouTube and type in his name, and there's online classes of just tons of information that he's done over the years that's really valuable, especially if you're trying to learn the craft yourself, or even just refresh on some areas. Yeah. It's a very interesting watch.
And his writing excuses podcast as well.
Yeah. I used to listen to him when I'd work out on the treadmill in the morning. I'd walk or run my mile or whatever I was doing, and I just have his podcast running and listening to his classes.
Totally worthwhile. Now, speaking of writing, we do have some questions coming in from our audience, so I'm going to pop this one up from Mike, who's asking about the co-authorship and how that works between two writers. Do you want to give us a little breakdown on how you do it?
I can let you guys know JC and my process, which, like I said, it took us a long time to figure out a process that worked without us killing each other. And it really came down to that we could not work on what the other person was working on at the same time. And so people who know me know that I'm a very big planner, plotter when I write stories. And so essentially we would sit down, we would plot out the story. We'd break down the entire arc for characters and storyline. And then we would divide up characters for who was writing what character. And then, of course, because of the way that we write, we don't do an omniscient third person. We do a limited third person when we write. So we break up chapters based on what character is in charge of that chapter, and just dividend up the chapters between each other. And then we share those back and forth. And then after we complete the entire novel, we go back through the other writer's chapters and we add our own flavor into there. So it blends very well. And I've had a lot of compliments with Annerfell, Heysheol, and Blood and Bile that we've both written, that people can't tell that's written by two different authors because of that tactic that we use.
That's pretty in depth. I mean, to be able to write individual characters without, you know, stepping on each other's toes, that's kind of hard to do, but you have your system, it works for you.
Yeah. Well, and of course we map out our characters too. So we know exactly who every character is, their strengths and their weaknesses, and then what their arcs look like, and then what the overall plot arc looks like, the story. So we know what's going in every chapter before we ever sit down and start writing.
Don't you ever get surprised though, by what your characters do? Like, you know who they are going into the chapter, but then literally one off the wall comment or one split second decision that you didn't see coming totally changes. As an example, in my Heirs of Destiny series, I knew how I wanted the series to progress. You know, I knew I had the whole book mapped out. I mean, this whole 5-book series mapped out. But by the time I got to the end, so much of the story had sort of shifted and changed. And then there's this big epic reveal that I had no intention of planning. You know, I didn't intend to put it in. It just came about and I had to sort of adapt. Does that ever happen to you guys?
Absolutely. And that's what I try to tell people. Even though I'm a big planner and a plotter, it's a working document. It's not fixed. It doesn't mean that it's going to stay that way all the way through. And so if I get into chapter 10 or JC gets into chapter 10 and we have this epiphany of what needs to happen or what needs to change, then we contact each other and we go back through and we rework the rest of the outline and we change it up and we fit that into the story. So it's a constantly working document that changes as those epiphanies come to light. But it's not fixed. I feel like people always think that because I plot it out, that's just the way it's going to be and it's always going to be that way. But no, Andy, you're right. There's moments where it's like, oh, that surprised me. Oh, this is a better idea. Oh, I should be writing it this way instead. And I just go back to the outline and I change it all. But that is another piece of it. When I co-write with JC, when we're working on a project, we're in contact with each other every single day. We spend about 90 minutes to 2 hours on the phone every single day that we're writing that book. So we contact each other. We talk about the chapter we wrote, what things happened, any little things that we added in there. Then we hop off, we go write our chapter, and then the next day we call again.
So you guys kind of write the story concurrently instead of it being, okay, one chapter and then the next sequence of the story, each chapter is kind of running alongside each other?
It is sequenced, but it's plotted out. So we know what the sequence is. But yeah, I might be writing chapter 3 while he's writing chapter 4. And so we get both of those done, and then we reach back out. And there's our holes at the time, but when we go back through and read through, then that's when we fill those holes up. So there are times we'll be like, oh man, you added this in chapter 4, and I had no idea you were doing that. Now we need to make allowances and go back into the first few chapters and make sure that we're building up to that or foreshadowing that.
It must probably be a bit slower to write, to co-write, than writing on your own.
It is. It is, absolutely. Yeah.
Now,
especially because I got to kick him in the butt to make him write faster.
How much slower? Like, aside from his writing speed, if you were writing on your own, how much progress would you make on the book in, say, a week versus how much progress you make in a week together?
I'm better with a month time frame because I can finish a full novel in a month by myself, but together it takes us about 6 months to write together for a book.
Wow. 6 months versus 1 month?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. Wow. And it's funny because you're writing half of the word count, but a lot of it is motivation and being on the, and I'm like, I'm a linear writer. So if he doesn't finish chapter 6, I can't go to chapter 7. Yeah. Like I want to have it in place and talk about it before I go write the next chapter. And so it's really my own hiccup and his motivation and doing things. JC is an excellent writer. He's probably more talented than I am, honestly, I think. But he's not as involved in writing stories. He enjoys writing stories. He enjoys telling stories, but being a full-time author is not a dream of his. So it's just kind of as he gets motivated or inspired, he'll sit down and work on a novel.
Gotcha. Cause I've been thinking about doing a co-writing thing, but I might even do more than you. I do about 40,000 words a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to find someone who would keep up with that output. Or, you know, like let's say I was co-writing a book with someone and the book would be 120,000 words. I'd have my book done in a week and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But then there'd be that whole side of the story that I wouldn't know. Okay, what are you doing? What am I missing? What do I need to include? And so I'm just not sure if it's the way to go.
Yeah, it's a little bit more. I mean, I average about 25,000 to 30,000 words a week when I'm sitting down to finish a book. So it's not quite at the same process, but yeah.
Well, you guys are something, man. Hey, what are you doing, cat? I got the cats laying on top of my headphones. Come on.
It's a busy process. I know. I'm working on a book right now. I've written, I think, 10,000 words in 2 days is what I've done so far.
Wow. That's awesome.
Oh, my Lord. Did you want to say hi to everyone? Is that the problem? Look at, say hi. Say hi, Leah. Get out of here. Go play somewhere else.
For those listening to the audio, Jason is playing with his cat.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the word count thing, though, because I'm really amazed at your numbers. And Jason, you've always told me that I write too fast. And I would say that our other co-host, Jane, writes too fast. But you guys just blow us both out of the water.
I never said too fast. I just said I was amazed and that I could never keep up with that. Like, I'm a 1,000 to 2,000 words a day if I'm in a good writing groove guy. You know, I could never, holy crap, 40,000 words a week. Is that what you said, Andy?
Yeah, that's about an average week.
That's awesome, man. I mean, see, Katie, now you know what you need to shoot for here. I'm not even going to shoot for that, but Katie, you can attain this.
You can do it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mine's not much different than that, Jason. I average about 3,000 to 4,000 words a day. And then if I'm really in the groove, I'll hit up to 6 or 7.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, man, that's...
See, I'm brain dead at 6,000 words.
But I mean, I won't necessarily... If I'm hitting 6 or 7, I won't necessarily write every day. Like, it sounds like Andy's just slamming away 6 to 7 every single day.
You know, it's weird because it's not like that. I say 40,000 a week because I write for 2 hours Monday afternoon, and that's only, you know, 2, 3, 4,000 words. I do about 2,000 words an hour, give or take. So Monday afternoon is usually only 4,000 words. Tuesday afternoon... another 4,000. Sometimes I can get Tuesday morning, so that goes 8,000 that day. But it's 2 hour shift. So like I'll get up, I'll have, you know, I'll do my morning work, have breakfast, sit down and write for 2 hours. And then I'll get up and I'll walk away from my computer because I finished the chapter. So then I'll cook lunch, I'll take a break, I'll watch TV, I'll take a nap if I'm lucky, you know, and then I sit down to write again. So it's sort of divided into these slots that are 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours at a time. But there's this this rest and recuperation between, so I, you know, my brain doesn't turn to goo. And then Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, I'll usually do 7 to 9, 9:30 maybe, have breakfast, take a break, 10:30 to 12:30, and then 2:30 to 4:30. But it's these chunks of time that I'm there, I'm working, I'm fully focused, and then I get up and I walk away afterwards. And it sort of helps me to keep
And are you outlining everything beforehand as well?
I have a pretty loose outline. Like I know the story beats, I know what needs to happen, I know what I want each chapter to end, you know, the hook, things like that. But there's a lot of room for the story to grow and flex and breathe, which is something that I found in this one. Right now, the story I'm working on, I intended it for it to be, you know, a full-size novel, which for me is like 120 to 140. When I finished the story, it was 157,000 words. And by the time I'm done editing it and fleshing it out and things like that, it's going to be minimum 200,000.
Oof, wow. Wow.
And it's just because, so it's military. So it's battles and it's tactics and it's strategies and things like that. So I, you know, you can't rush these things. You know, it can take a full 1,000 words to describe the military, you know, the shield wall buckling and people dying and the enemy's triumph at killing people. And then another 1,000 words to describe what the main character does in 20 seconds to 2 minutes to take back the battle. And so it's just this crazy involved thing. And then, of course, there's 7 main characters, just one point of view character, because I'm never doing multiple point of view characters again.
Yeah, I feel on that one. Andy and actually talked about this. What was this, about a month and a half ago? We were both working simultaneously on multiple POV books, and we didn't know. And I finished mine about the same time you finished yours. You're like, God, that was brutal.
Such a nightmare. My head was just like I would write for an hour. I'd finish the chapter, and I'd have to get up and walk around and do something, because it would be like, all right, I'm going from this character with this very complete set of psychological issues to this character with their own very different set of them.
Yeah, and yeah. So Death at Dusk was 4 POV, isn't it? I was like, I'm never doing that again.
Absolutely. It's such a But so the chapters tend to grow, the story tends to get bigger when I overcomplicate everything, or I always make things as big as possible. So yeah, 200,000 words is pretty much what this one's gonna turn out to be.
Well, and I have a question for you. And what I'm looking for from either one of you or both of you is a tip here. So I'll set up the scene here for you. So when I get going really well, and usually that's during November, National Novel Writing, when I'm really putting down the hammer, and I'll have a week where I'm doing, you know, 2,000-3,000 words a day. And because I'm in a groove and I've been thinking about, okay, you know, I already have the first, you know, 10 chapters in my head of what I want to do. But then all of a sudden I run out of that, you know, in my brain plotting, and I'm like, oh shit, wait, I don't know what's coming next. And then my 3,000 words a day comes grinding to a halt as I'm trying to figure out what the hell to do next. Now, with this novel that I'm working on now, I've actually outlined the whole thing. And of course, it's not really following the outline all that well, but you know, that is what it is. And so now when I sit down, I've got a couple hours, a couple days a week that I can write. So I'll sit down and I'm spending a half an hour just trying to get into the zone to figure out what I'm doing here. How do you get yourself to the point where you're just sitting down and boom, writing? You know, what's your ritual, or how do you train yourself to do that?
Joshua, you can go first.
Sure. Mine's pretty simple, honestly. I get up, get all the kids started on their morning routines, because we homeschool, of course, as well. And so I get all them doing their thing. I go make my cup of coffee, come up to the computer, and I sit down. And my process is always that I read through the last couple of pages that I wrote the day before. I do edit while I write. So I read through those 2 pages. I kind of do some simple editing if there's anything I need to change up or word a little bit differently to kind of get myself into the flow of the story. And then I jump into the next chapter. But I don't know if this is true for you or not, Jason. When I write a story, or when I am outlining the story, I pick the ending of my story, and then I backtrack to what led up to that ending. So it's not really ever a question of what comes after the first 10 chapters. It's more of like, I always know where I'm going, and then I backtrack in my outline to the event that led up to that, and I build my character up to that event. So that's how I've always told stories. It's like, even the calendar series, it's a 3-book series, and I knew how the 3rd book was going to end before I ever started writing the 1st book. And so I backtrack outlined up to that point of what my characters needed to get through in order to make them into the characters that need to be at the end of the book.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So for me, I like to end chapters with the hook, where something is about to go wrong, you know, and then it's easy because something's about to go wrong. So you just make it go wrong and then the characters react and the story just kind of continues itself. And so when you end each chapter with this hook, you know, the negotiations with the potential allied king is going great. And all of a sudden our enemies are 2 days away. Now, what are we going to do? We've just spelled out this whole plan. How are we going to adapt and change our plan to meet that? And so then it just sort of segues into this discussion that's so easy to go through because I know what I'm going to do, but then the characters, they've been having this conversation or they've been fighting this fight or whatever it is. They've been doing something. All of a sudden the situation changes or there's a new threat. So how do they respond? That right there, that response or that reaction is super easy to write. And then it just sort of leads right into what comes next in the story overall.
So you always leave yourself on a little bit of a cliffhanger there just to kind of spur yourself on. Okay.
Yeah.
What about you, Katie? How do you get down to writing once you sit down?
Yeah. Whenever I can actually do it. I try during the day to think about the scene that I want to write because my goal is word count oriented, but I also want to finish a scene each time I sit down to write. So I try as much as possible to think about what I want to have happen so that when I do sit down, I'm ready to write that scene. But life gets in the way, kids get in the way. In the comments, we were just talking about how your kids always needing snacks throws me off, you know, my game, and I can't think of what I was supposed to be doing. So, you know, in practice, it doesn't always work as well. And I do end up, you know, kind of like you, that first 30 minutes that I'm sitting down, I'm going, okay, what was I going to write again? And I have to either backtrack and look at what I just wrote or go look at my to-do list that I write for my characters because I don't outline. I do to-do lists. And go, okay, where can I start from on this to-do list and write about it? And Josh, like you, I'm a very linear writer. I don't like to hopscotch over chapters if I don't know how to get through them. So that is another stumbling block I run into. If I can't figure out how to get between chapter 5, 6, and 7, I end up sitting there staring at the blank screen again until I can come up with that bridge point. So there's a lot of, you know, staring at the blank cursor that happens, unfortunately.
And I hate that damn blank cursor, man. It kills me. But you know, I'll tell you what, doing the outline for this most recent project, really has helped because I was feeling really uninspired last year when it came to writing. I just wasn't feeling it as much as I normally do. And having the outline, I was like, man, you know, I feel energized about this. You know, I feel charged up. And that was a really good thing. So I was geeked to finally actually grow up and try that. And it's been working fairly well. Duct tape sounds good. I'm not sure what we're using the duct tape for, Amanda. But duct tape is great for, you know, fixing stuff around the house or tying up Joshua if we're delivering him to Rebecca. That works too.
I think she was referring to the silencing the children.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's frowned upon now, I think. Yeah, no, not in Canada. Good. I actually, you guys were talking about getting off track with your outlines, and I had this beautiful outline done for the new book, and now my main character is contemplating murdering someone. And this is not a murdery kind of book whatsoever. I mean, it is not that kind of book. And I'm like, come on now, we really don't want to do this, do we? It's going to fuck everything else up if we actually do this. So, but you know, knowing me, she's going to have to kill somebody, I think.
Yeah. So this is one misconception that people have about outlines is that you always stick to it. Outlines are there as a guide. They, you know, where you wanted the story to go, right? You know, you wanted these highs, these lows, these tension points, these threats, challenges, ultimate struggles, climaxes, whatever you want. But how you get there, and sometimes even where you get, will change according to the story. And so when you're dealing with people in your story, you know, you're writing human people, sometimes their reactions aren't as cut and dry as the outline you've created. You know, when you're sitting down to write an outline, you're in one frame of mind. But then when you sit down to write the characters, you're in another frame of mind. Your moods change, the music is affecting your mood, the coffee's making your brain run on overdrive, whatever the case is, something's changed since you wrote the outline. So things will change. It will shift. Maybe your outline will have to be scrapped, or maybe it'll have to be adjusted. But the fact
don't that say know, that I spent so long on it. Come on,
that's totally awesome because it means that you did give it some thought. You knew, you know, you had the highs and lows planned, but then things change, and so you have to let the story breathe. This is sort of like I treat each scene like wine. You know, you're supposed to let it sit and breathe. And so if you rush through the scene to get through, you know, to the emotional revelation or to the danger or to the threat or whatever, you're not going to really make it work. Whereas if you let each scene breathe and really get where it needs to go in its own time, then you'll find that the reactions are more genuine and more organic. And then when you find out, okay, my character is going to go off my original script, you know why they're doing it. And then you can sort of adapt and adjust accordingly.
Yeah, go ahead, Josh.
I was just going to say, I'm absolutely the same way, Jason, that my outline and my character outline, both of them for the story and the characters, inspires me and motivates me. Like when people talk about getting writer's block or not being able to figure out what to do, that's what I go back to. I go back to my outlines and I read back through them. And it's like this, oh yeah, that's what I was doing. And I get excited about it again when I first created the outline and the story. And so it helps me jump back into it. But like Andy's saying, I find this too. Honestly, the first 10,000 words are the hardest words for me to write of any story that I start. And it's because I have this black and white, cut and dry idea of who my characters are, but their personalities really haven't become formed. Like I might have a character that's sophisticated and et cetera, et cetera. But maybe he's just too dry in the way that he expresses his sophistication. And it's finding those little ticks about his personality that really bring him to light and make him exciting and entertaining. And that's where I find that my outline changes. I start kind of picking up on who he is. Maybe he's very sarcastic in his sophistication. He puts down other people. And as this starts to develop and grow through the story, what I had in my outline originally doesn't work because I realized that my character A would actually respond differently than what I had initially outlined. And that's where the changeup comes, because now my character has really become more full as an individual, and they're more real and they're more realistic and more natural and genuine and all these things as I'm writing about him. And that's where I start changing my outline, being like, okay, this guy's going to have more of a role than I thought he did because his character wouldn't allow these other things to happen.
Yeah. And then like I outline an entire series at a time, but books change, you know. For the Heirs of Destiny series, I had to totally overhaul almost half of books three and four, because the story shifted just enough that it needed to be changed. And so there were a couple of times when I was like, all right, now what am I going to do? And I actually had to stop writing. I took afternoons or mornings off of writing.
No.
To reshape my outline according to the new settings, the new characters, the new threats, whatever had happened through the story that changed from the original outline, I had to adapt it. And that's what makes outlines so useful, is you know where you want to go. What changes is how you get there. And maybe sometimes the destination changes, but not so drastically.
Yeah. And I feel like going off outline right now, I'm doing it for the best of reasons. I'm doing it because it's more true to my character. And even if I don't let her actually kill somebody, she really would like to. You know, she's a teenage girl who's just found out that one of her best friends is being abused at home. And with all the crap that she's going through in her life, adding this into it is just kind of pushing her over the edge. And it's supposed to be more of a coming of age, and it's going very, very dark. So I don't know that I actually want her to be a murderer, but it's kind of like, okay, you know, this really is how she feels, you know? She really does want to kill this guy, you know. You know, she's furious and she's hurt and she's angry. But yeah.
So Jason, why don't you take another Word document opened and write that scene? See, Katie, if you like it. You know, feel it out a little bit. Maybe you like it, maybe you scrap it, but at least then it's out of your brain because you're mulling over it. So you're clearly kind of want to do it, even though you don't know if it's going to fit into the story. So why not write it? Keep it separate. If it fits, put it in. If it doesn't, at least you've written it. And maybe that can become something else later.
Well, and I like that idea. However, I won't open a Word document. I'll just click the little plus button in Scrivener and add another little document to my project. That way it's all right there for me anyway. But that's a good idea, Katie. I like that.
Or, you know, trust yourself. The fact that the scene has, this character that you've written has started to shift this way. Lean into it. See where it's going, and see what happens with it. And, you know, you, the writer, have these subconscious and unconscious thoughts and desires and beliefs and opinions and reactions, just like, you know, that shape your characters and your scene, just like your characters have their own that are alien from you. So if your character's thinking, all right, I need to murder this person, follow through with that. Walk your character and yourself through the emotional journey of, should I murder this guy or not? They could even end up planning the murder and going to murder someone, and then they don't go through it for X reason, or they do go through it. Like, let yourself feel it out a little bit.
That's okay. What I really like how you word that, Andy, because I've never really been underneath the belief that my characters speak to me or they guide me. It's really my own expression and projection of things in my own conscious and subconscious that I've been put into my characters, and I'm exploring that journey through them for whatever it is that I want to do. And so when I find, like I was saying earlier, my sophisticated character is sarcastic and it never goes this way, it's not because my character did something that impacted me or I'm going with the flow because they're speaking to me in some way. It's because I had this revelation or this idea, or I came into connection with some idea in my own head that I found a better story than what I originally conceived. Mm-hmm. And we're all shaped by our experiences and our journeys in life and the things that we go through. And so by writing the story and bringing it to life in your own imagination, it then gave you multiple paths of other options that could very well be a better story than what you originally thought out. You don't have to just gung-ho stick to the original outline because it was there, because now you brought it to life and you can see other doors of opportunity opening up.
Damn. It's amazing. It's amazing where these things will lead you. The young adult character in my Heirs of Destiny series, which was intended to be a spinoff but standalone and end, they solve a massive world-shattering problem that is in my Hero of Darkness series. No planning, no intention of having that. But because of the journey that I took my character on from the beginning of her story, by the time she reaches the end, and this thing came up and it just sort of popped into my brain, and I was like, holy shit, this totally is awesome, because now I get to write more of their story in relation to that. And it just happens. So this is one thing that I've learned over, I think I'm on like book 20 right now. Just trust your instincts, that you know where it's going, that subconsciously or unconsciously or consciously or a combination of all three, you will get the story where it needs to go. You are going to be telling the best, most honest story possible.
If I have learned anything in writing, I'm going to completely piggyback on what Andy is saying. It's been that. I mean, I write epic series and sagas with multiple stories that all intertwine with each other, and they all fit together like a nicely pieced puzzle. Maybe readers will find some holes that I missed in that. But I found in writing books that there's always an answer. There's always something that comes together. They all will fit together. I just have to wait in order for me to find it. It eventually will be there. And sometimes it's brainstorming. Sometimes it's thinking about it. Sometimes I just go run and I just let my imagination wander while I'm playing with it. But there's always a way to fill the gap and make the story interlock with itself. There's always a way. They'll always fit together. You'll always come up with some possibility, because the human mind in of itself is what's the word I'm looking for? It's crafted. It's created. Its ability is to put... I'm trying to find a way to word this so it makes sense. It has the ability to fill holes with information. So often we find problems in our world or things that don't quite make sense, and we make it make sense.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like we make lines exist where they shouldn't be there. We make 3D figures where maybe there shouldn't be. So we see faces in things where there's not faces at. We make reality around us. We make it work for us. And you do the same thing when you write fiction.
You know, it's an interesting thing that I've discovered is my characters tend to be a little bit more overt in their emotional growth and development. Like, I will actually have the character walk himself or herself through the steps that lead them from, yes, I'm going to kill this person, to no, I'm not going to kill this person. And it's sort of this psychological or emotional exercise for myself, because I will understand how they got there. So when I spell it out on the page, it also helps the reader understand. But really, it's for me, because I need to understand. Like in the Hero of Darkness series, the hunter has to decide whether or not to kill 750,000 people. You'd think it would be an easy answer, right? But it's not. And so when I started writing the story, I was like, now, do I want this character to be willing to kill 750,000 people or not? And I didn't know. I still didn't know how I wanted the story to end until I got to the scene where he's thinking, you know, he's had all this information thrown at him. He's had his emotional development, and I still didn't know. And then I sat down and I started writing. Okay, how does he feel about this? How does he feel about people in general? Okay, This is how he feels. Now, how does he feel about people, specific people, right? The people who matter to him. And then like I walked him through this emotional journey one step at a time, basically spoon feeding it to him, to myself, so that I got where I needed to go. So if you do the same with your, with this murdery teenager, walk her through this one little sentence, one baby step at a time until she comes to a realization, you come to the realization that yes, murdering this guy's okay. No, murdering this guy's not okay. Here's why, here's why not. It'll be much more real because you, the author, will have understood how she, you, got to where she, you are.
Damn, man. You guys are freaking good. Holy shit. Wow. Man, I'm going to hang up and start writing right now, man, because I've got all sorts of ideas floating around in here. And speaking of crazy stuff floating around, could you pop up Rebecca's last comment on back up on the screen there, Katie?
This one?
We didn't. No.
That's the one I see.
Yeah.
You mean that one? Yeah. When so, murdering 750,000 people, Rebecca?
If it fits, shove it in there. I think that she was referring to holes that you might find in one of Joshua's stories. She just wants to shove something in there. Rebecca, we really appreciate the comment. I wanted to make sure we acknowledge you. Oh, goodness. Oh, Joe. Yes. Oh, yes. No, that's wonderful advice, guys. And Katie, I'm going from taking your advice on writing that other document to just, I'm just going leaning right into it because these guys have got me convinced that we got to kill some people.
Jason secretly can't wait to kill people, everybody.
Well, you might be following the wrong role models when it comes to writing your fiction, because I think Joshua's body count might be slightly higher than mine. I can't be sure, but it's a pretty close thousands right now.
If all else fails, use brute force and duct tape, right?
Yes, there you go.
Brute force and duct tape. We'll get anything to fit in there.
The only thing is, if you do kill them, this is the important part of storytelling, is that you have to make sure that there's the emotional journey afterwards. You have to make sure there's the impact of the action and not just leave it to essentially filter off the dust. And I see that a lot in fantasy novels, or at least in a lot of recent works where people will do things and there's not that emotional piece afterwards attached to it, and it makes it fall flat. And the reader does not connect with that.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. And that's the whole too much action, not enough character. But yeah. And you know what, this is going to seem off topic, Katie, but really it's not, I promise. Have any of you seen the movie Kingsman?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
I have not.
Oh,
ruin it for me.
Well,
spoiler alert.
No, it's okay. I don't mind movies being rude.
Dude, the movie is awesome, so you should totally watch it. But there's at one point towards the end of our main character Eggsy's training where he's asked to do something just morally despicable in order to prove himself a Kingsman, which seems to be kind of a common theme in spy movies and shit like that. And in the end, he can't do it because that's not the kind of person he is. And every time I see this scene, I'm battling with myself. Cause I'm like, no, you're supposed to do it to prove yourself. And then I'm like, no, do you really want a person that's capable of doing this thing? I'm like, no, I don't. So in the end, my morality would say, no, he made the right decision and look how everything turned out. But I don't really know if I had a point with this. It was something that popped up into my head, and maybe I should go watch that movie tonight after the show, Katie.
Use that as your inspiration. And I think it does tie in because you went on that journey with that character, only maybe you would have made a different choice. And so that's why you're struggling.
I wouldn't have.
You secretly want to kill something.
I wouldn't have because I've got one of those. I can't spoil it for Josh, but yeah, I totally wouldn't have, because that was I would have made the same decision right there, and I wish that I could parkour like Eggsy.
Yeah, but you know, that's interesting. It's interesting that in fantasy that violence is one of the most common emotional traits, or you know, the most character development tools used, because that's one of the few things that kind of existed in this sort of world. You know, there are a lot of challenges that people face, but violence there, it's the most visual one, right? The most overt. So when your character is confronted, hit, don't hit, kill, don't kill, it's pretty easy to see, you know, their reaction, and it's a great way to play with that. So I do it all the time because it's so much fun because, you know, you get to have this character. One of my characters, he's this guy, he's been fighting to live on the streets for years, and yet he still makes a point to not kill people. He punches the shit out of them, but he doesn't kill them because for him, that is one step too far. And he's, you know, he's going up against people, sort of like how Spider-Man, you know, he keeps arresting the same villains over yeah. and over and over.
Right? Spider-Man doesn't kill people. Yeah.
So, but that's the thing. And that is a huge part of their psyche. And it's what makes them the character that they are. And so it's interesting to push your characters to this point. And when I say your characters, like Josh said, it's not these living, breathing things that operate independent of you. It's this piece of yourself that you have breathed life into. You've put you with someone else and other people and these little things taken from everywhere. You've created this pastiche, and they're operating independently of you in the sense that they have their own way of thinking that might not be the same as yours. And yet they're still you to a certain extent. So you push them and yourself to this point, and then you get to see how you would react in the situation, and then how they, with their psyche that is similar yet not identical to yours, would react in the same situation. And it's one of the best ways to get to understand people, the world mm-hmm. around you, because Joshua and I have tons in common, very little in common, right? But then when we're confronted with the same situation, who knows how we're going to respond? But if I can say, okay, now Joshua is a father just like me. He's a husband just like me. Now he's grown up totally different than me. So when someone punches him, he doesn't punch them back versus how I do. I can understand his thing because I can see the similarities and differences. And that's something that we as authors do by creating these characters that are similar to us and different from us.
Wow. So, Joshua, you're more of a lover, not a fighter, then?
I have long had the belief that it's always better to outsmart somebody and screw them over intellectually than ever go fist to fist.
Yeah. I like that. And it's that's awesome coming from such a gigantic, crazy, mean-looking guy. I mean, you look like you just pound the shit out of people.
I've been told so many times. I've been in plenty of fights in my life, and I used to spar regularly. I've trained with MMA fighters. I've taken several martial arts. I enjoy fighting for sport and having fun with that, but if I were actually being targeted, I think, by somebody else, I much rather find a way to overthrow them intellectually than ever go fist-to-fist, because I get more pleasure out of that.
See, that's
the dark side of me. Like I rather screw you over long term than in the immediate.
I like that. I like it. I'm not smart enough for that. I'd have to run away.
Which is something I like to instill. That's a piece of my characters that I love doing. I like them playing the long game and the end game. I do have characters that will do the short term and just go, you know, fist to fist. Tyr Ogg is one of them. He's the giant, and he just rages and goes into this immediate, like, I'm going to pummel your face in, and never thinks long-term. But I really enjoy playing the characters that do the long-term, that really be like, okay, I can't get you now, but I can do this, this, and this. It's going to impact you in a month, a year, 10 years.
The game of chess. Yes.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Katie? Are you punching the shit out of somebody, or are you trying to outsmart them?
No, I'm too short to defend myself. I'm too small and weak, so I have to use my brain.
Small and weak.
I grew up small and weak, and then I got big, but I'm not as big as Andy.
Andy, I'm only 5 foot tall, so I'm a little short thing.
Andy, so you're even bigger than Joshua.
Okay. I guess.
I'm 6'3", so okay. I think you got me beat by a couple inches.
I'm 6'6".
Holy shit balls!
Yeah. I'm actually the smallest guy in my family.
Wow, this is like the fantasy Hulk convention thing going on here, man. I gotta see you guys side by side sometime. That'd be impressive. And then we'll put Katie in there with you.
Look like a little baby in comparison.
It's crazy though, like how that works though, because I was really small when I was young. Like seventh grade, I was 5'3", weighed maybe 75 pounds. I was a little small thing, and then puberty hit mid high school, and I just shot right up, gained like 65 pounds in a year, started doing weightlifting and training, and Yeah.
And when did the beard come in?
About 2 months ago.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Katie. What were you going to say?
I was going to say it's the small person mentality too. You have to instill that into your children as well to, you know, learn how to use their words to fight rather than trying to go toe to toe with somebody, because, you know, you don't have the leverage really. So if you can use your mind, if you can use your words, you can do a lot of damage with words if used correctly. And so that's kind of what I do with my children too. I'm like, I don't want you guys getting into fights. If you're confronted in a bully situation, try and use your words against them. Try and outsmart them. Try to make them, you know, stop doing what they're doing. Show them that you're not afraid of them without having to get involved in any kind of physical altercation. It'll work out better for you in the long run. And it has, with my oldest, proven to work out.
Yeah, I am really bad at teaching my kids snark. I really like the snarky response when they're being bullied. You know, somebody name calls them, like, just come back, be like, man, you must really have a rough life at home. Like,
that's awesome.
Like that's
exactly what we teach them to.
Yeah, or if they're in the classroom and they're being bullied, just like yell really loud so the teacher can hear you and be like, get your hands off of me. Stop touching me there. That's my private spots. Like, just... like, just blow it out of proportion so they'll leave you alone.
Yes. Oh, I like that.
My oldest daughter can snark back, you know, with the quickness. She's got that quick wit. My boy, on the other hand, he's the one, don't touch me!
Yep.
And Andy's over here as another father being like, you're a terrible dad, Josh.
Yeah.
My kids don't need any help with that. They're teenagers now, so they got that on lock.
Oh, shoot. Well, what do you guys have coming up that you want to talk about to people here? Some new releases? Anything?
I just got into the Dark Dominions anthology with my short story called Rin the Red Falcon, which is a new world that I've built based on Sumerian mythology. It's very Conan-esque or Red Sonja-esque. And it was a short story that got accepted into that anthology. It's one of the first to support gender equality, and they're running a Kickstarter for it to raise funds for its publication. So that's out right now. My most recent release has been Death at Dusk, which is a standalone novel in the Thrice Nine Legends. It's about assassins and mercenaries fighting over a princess's life in a very enigmatic forest. It was a lot of fun. When you purchase that book, you get 3 free songs that were specifically composed for Thrice Nine Legends. So those are very cool. That is in there. And then right now, what I'm writing, what I've been talking about, is I'm working on a codex of Thrice Nine Legends, which includes everything about my world building. So all the characters, all the races, all the gods, all the mythology, the legend, the lores, all the timeline history for 3,000, 4,000 years, etc., all put together in a compendium that allows readers to essentially get all the information they wanted to know that's not in the books because it's not immediately relevant to the story.
Wow. And do you ever worry that you're going to like lock yourself into a corner with these, like having the world history built, now you can't make it up as you go.
It's not like the outline anymore.
I've had it built for so long. I go back to what I was saying earlier, Andy, is that I always find your way. So even if I have to pull a freaking X-Men Wolverine and rewrite in a different timeline, I'll find a way. We'll do alternate realities. It'll work.
That's it. Yeah. That's the reason that I've refused to build my whole world. Like right now there are like 3 maps of my world and there are 2 cities and then 1 continent. There's still this big nebulous continent that I refuse to define because I can keep adding more bits and pieces onto it and expanding the world and adding new cultures and things like that as I want to.
That's, you know, I had something else I was going to say, but it was totally off topic. So we're going to skip over that. Sorry, Katie. I'm sorry for even thinking it, Katie. Andy, tell us about what you've got going on.
All right. Well, I guess the next release comes out in just over 2 weeks. It's the 4th book in the Heirs of Destiny series. That is a sequel spinoff to both Hero of Darkness and Queen of Thieves. It's aimed at younger audiences, so there's like a third as much death and destruction, and it's actually like much more upbeat than my other stuff, so it's much funner, more fun to read. And then the 4th book is March 19th, the fifth book comes out in April, and then by mid-year, I'll have box sets and a new series coming out in September.
Wow, that is impressive. Man, you guys are freaking workhorses. I am so inspired. And this whole thing has really turned into teach Jason how to write gooder. And I really appreciate that because I needed some inspiration, man. It's been dark days over here. I needed this. What about you, Katie? What do you have coming out or what do you have going on?
I have absolutely nothing coming out right now. Isn't that horrible?
That is terrible. It's been, what, a month since you released something? Jeez.
Look, I'm trying. All right. No, actually, I was just talking to my cover artist and trying to get on her schedule so that I can get the next three books in the Agents of Asset series done this year. So wow. That is my current project.
That's awesome. Who are you doing for cover artist on those ones again?
I'm using Molly Phipps at We Got You Covered for that series. She also did my Little Werewolf series, and I really liked what she did with that one. I like the kind of Jason Bourne-esque feel she gave my agents.
Yeah, I like it too. I do.
So yeah, I like what she does.
Is she the same one that did the, she's not the same one that did Chronicles, is she?
No. That's Christian, and I'll probably butcher his last name. He has really good, like, movie cinematic feel covers.
Yeah,
and
that beautiful.
Perfectly fit that series.
Yeah, those were gorgeous. You and I are going to be working on an audiobook production. So that'll be fun. That'll kind of be our project over the summer here. So I'm excited about that. And I'm just going to keep picking away at short stories and novel projects and keep running the new podcast. And yeah, we're all living life and living the good life.
Just keep writing.
Just keep writing. Write or die, baby. Well, all right, everybody. We are at our time for today, but I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. And I want to especially thank Rebecca for always sharing her very funny, somewhat inappropriate comments with us. We do appreciate them. And for everyone else who's commenting out there. And thank you so much, Joshua and Andy. You guys have been just a blast. And Joshua, I already knew you, but Andy, it was great to meet you, man. I've heard so much about you.
It was nice to meet you again, too. We've been on like two podcasts together.
No, we haven't. No, we haven't. Come on now.
No.
We've been on, I know, at least one of Joe's Indie Now podcasts.
Joe has brought us all together. Yeah. He is really like the glue in the indie community, I think.
He really is. Joe is a cool guy. Joe, we love you, brother. We really do. You're a great man. So, all right, everybody. That's it for tonight. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys. All right, we are clear.
Click, click.
Thank you for listening to Spilling Ink.